we turn our attention now to mitigating factors. Call it part two, where we look at the law of contracts. We're still looking at law of contract. We're looking at mitigating factors. And mitigating factors simply mean terms or circumstances that invalidate a contract. And that contract can either be invalidated from the outset, or it can be valid and then rendered invalidated. So we looked at mistake on the last occasion, so we are going to look now at misrepresentation. And we begin, as always, with definitions. So misrepresentation, so a representation, what is the definition of misrepresentation? A representation is a statement of fact made by one party to the contract, the representor, to the other, the representee, which, while not forming a term of the contract, is one of the reasons that induces the representee to enter into the contract. Now remember that when we're looking at contract, statements that were mere representation and statements that were a term of the contract. So here we're talking about representation that is not a term of the contract, but it is the basis on which the person may enter the contract, meaning they were induced to enter the contract based on this representation, which turns out to be a misrepresentation. Now, a misrepresentation is a representation that is untrue, and I believe that is very clear and straightforward. So a misrepresentation is a representation that's untrue. So in defining what a misrepresentation is, we first define the term representation. Then we spoke about misrepresentation, and a misrepresentation is simply a representation that is untrue. It's not true. So, still looking at the meaning of misrepresentation, there are some elements that must be established. A, it must be a statement of fact, not a statement of intention or of opinion or of law. It must be a statement of fact. Now, the statement may be written, spoken, or by conduct. Related to the fact that it must be a statement of fact, we look at the effect of a statement of opinion. So a statement of opinion, for example, that the goods represent good value, cannot amount to a misrepresentation unless the maker of the statement is an expert or has expert knowledge or has special knowledge. And again, this would not be a surprise to you, because we would have seen that when we were looking at the business here of a statement that is mere representation as opposed to a statement that is a term of the contract, that if the person who is making the statement holds themselves out as an expert or that they have special knowledge, then in that regard, it would be a term of the contract and not simply a mere representation. Right? And that's the difference between an opinion and a statement of fact. So in Brissett and Wilkinson, and again like mistake, this area looks heavily at the common law. So in Brissett and Wilkinson, the vendor of land stated that it would support 2,000 sheep. Turned out that this was not the case, but the vendor was not liable because the land had not previously been used for sheep, and the purchaser knew this. The statement was held to be one of opinion, not fact. So here we are distinguishing now between statement of opinion as opposed to a statement of fact. So misrepresentation, a statement of opinion may by implication involve a statement of fact. And the case that illustrates this point is Smith and Land and House Properties Corporation. So the vendor of a hotel described it as let to Mr. Frederick Fleck, a most desirable tenant. The tenant was in fact in arrears with his rent. It was held that this statement was a statement of fact, since the vendor was impliedly stating that he knew the fact that supported his opinion that the tenant was desirable. And the fact is the tenant was not desirable. Now, remember we said that a statement, for there to be misrepresentation, the representation must be a statement of fact, not a statement of opinion, not a statement of law, right? And not a statement of intention. So we look at a statement of intention now. So a statement of intention is not a misrepresentation unless it can be proved that the alleged intention never existed. But in Eddington and Fitzmaurice, plaintiff was induced to lend money to a company because the directors said they intended to use the money to finance expansion. In fact, this intention never existed since directors needed the money to pay off the company's debts. It was held that there had been a fraudulent misrepresentation. We'll come back to fraudulent misrepresentation later on. Now, a false statement of the law cannot be misrepresentation since everybody is presumed to know the law. So again, we're looking at what is a misrepresentation and we're looking at the definition of misrepresentation. So B, silence is not usually misrepresentation except 1. When a statement made in the course of negotiation subsequently becomes false and is not corrected, or 2, when silence distorts a literally true statement. The case here is R and Kilsant, Queen and Kilsant, and here a company, when inviting the public to subscribe for its shares, stated that it had paid a regular dividend throughout the years of the depression. This clearly implied that the company had made a profit during those years. This was not the case since the dividends had been paid out of accumulated profit of the previous or pre-depression years. The company's silence as to the source of the dividends was held to be a misrepresentation since it distorted the true statement that the dividends had been paid. We have already looked at the question of whether silence is communication or silence is consent, and I told you unequivocally, silence is not consent, and so silence is not communication. And in this particular instance, a representation had been made that the company paid dividends during the years of the depression, but they did not go on to qualify that this was out of cumulative profits or surplus. So the other element of misrepresentation that we need to take into consideration is that where the contract is of utmost good faith, ubrime fide, then if the person is not truthful, then that would be a misrepresentation. And ubrime fide is the Latin for utmost good faith, and this is the underbelly of contract formation. When you enter into a contractual arrangement, whether it is a verbal contract, a written contract, or a contract by conduct, you are doing so in good faith. So the person is going to rely on what you are saying. So it is very important that one is truthful. Now, the other element is that misrepresentation must induce the contract. The misrepresentation must induce the contract. The plaintiff, therefore, cannot avoid the contract if 1, he knew the statement was false, or 2, he would have made the contract despite the misrepresentation, or 3, he did not know that there was a misrepresentation. The case here is horse fall and Thomas. The vendor of a gun concealed a defect in the gun. And this is a misrepresentation by conduct. Buyer purchased the gun without examining it. Therefore, the concealing of the defect could not have affected his decision as to whether or not to purchase it. His actions, therefore, failed. But that brings us to the types of misrepresentation. And there are three types of misrepresentation. There is fraudulent misrepresentation, there is negligent misrepresentation, and there is innocent misrepresentation. We're going to look at them in turn. Starting with fraudulent misrepresentation. What is fraudulent misrepresentation? A statement which is known to be false or made without belief in its truth or recklessly, not hearing whether it is true or false. And that definition of fraudulent misrepresentation is to be found in the case Derry and Peake. In Derry and Peake, a company had a power conferred by a special act of parliament to run trams by animal power and with Board of Trade consent by steam or mechanical power. Company invited applications for shares from the public and stated in the prospectus that they had power to run trams by steam. They had assumed that Board of Trade permission would be granted, but in the event, it was not. As a result, the directors were sued for fraud. Court formulated the definition of fraud that we stated above and held that the directors were not liable since they honestly believed their statement to be true. So that now brings us to the remedies for fraudulent misrepresentation. So we're entering now into the realm of remedies. If the innocent party has suffered loss, he may claim damages based on the tort of deceit. In addition, he may refuse to perform the contract and claim rescission of the contract. Since fraud makes a contract voidable, the innocent party may choose to affirm the contract. So unlike mistake, misrepresentation renders a contract voidable, which means that the contract is valid until it is avoided. So that now brings us to the effect of fraudulent mistake on a contract. So when a contract is voidable, it will generally be valid until the other party is informed of the avoidance. So to avoid the contract, you know, to inform the other party that you are not going forward with the contract. However, where the seller has a right to avoid for fraud, he does so if, on discovering the fraud, he takes all reasonable steps to recover the goods. Here's a case that illustrates the point. So in Carr and Universal Finance against Caldwell, a person was induced to sell his car to a crook. The crook's check was dishonored and the crook could not be found. Immediately the check was dishonored, the former owner informed the police and the Automobile Association and asked them to find his car. It was held that since he had done all he could in the circumstances, he had successfully avoided the contract. So it is vital to avoid a contract induced by fraud as soon as possible. Fraudulent misrepresentation. If the crook sells after avoidance, he cannot pass title, and thus the third party to whom he has sold must bear the loss. And that now brings us to innocent misrepresentation. So an innocent misrepresentation, a statement which the maker honestly and reasonably believes to be true. Where there has been an innocent misrepresentation, innocent party has no right to damages, but may ask the court to grant the equitable remedy of rescission, i.e., restore to the pre-contract state of affairs. That's restoration to the pre-contract state of affairs. And the treatment of innocent misrepresentation is very terse, but when we come to Lloyd and Long, we'll see that case illustrates innocent misrepresentation. So we turn now to negligent misrepresentation. And negligent misrepresentation is where a negligent misrepresentation is a false statement made by a person who had no reasonable grounds for believing it to be true. So in fraudulent misrepresentation, the person knew they were lying, but they told the lie anyway. In innocent misrepresentation, it was not true, but the person honestly believed that it was true, so they didn't have any intent to mislead or to deceive. And in negligent misrepresentation, the statement is false, but the person really couldn't care less whether it is true or not. Right? They didn't pay sufficient attention. So when negligent misrepresentation is concerned, the innocent party has a right to damages for misrepresentation if he has suffered loss. So the innocent party is entitled to be put in the position in which he would have been if the representation had been true. So that brings us to the bars to rescission. Remember that rescission is an equitable remedy that's available if the equitable rules of mistake are applied, or in the case of negligent misrepresentation or innocent misrepresentation where rescission is permissible, then that is a remedy, but there are bars to rescission. And the question is, what are these bars to rescission? So the remedy of rescission will not be available in the following situations. One, if the innocent party with knowledge of his rights affirmed the contract. Two, lapse of time. Three, if restitutio in integrum is impossible. And four, the intervention of third party rights. If the innocent party with knowledge of his rights affirmed the contract, then that's a bar to rescission. So you can't now go on with the contract and then say, oh, you changed your mind. That's not going to happen. So the case here is Lloyd and Long. And Lloyd and Long illustrates bars to rescission, but it also illustrates innocent misrepresentation. So let's listen to this. In Lloyd and Long, the plaintiff was induced to buy a lorry from the defendant after hearing representation as to its condition and a statement that it would do 11 miles to the gallon. Plaintiff drove the lorry home from Hampton Court to Seven Oaks. The next Wednesday, the plaintiff drove to Rochester, and during the journey, the dynamo ceased to function. An oil leak developed, a crack appeared in one of the wheels, and petrol consumption was 5 miles per gallon. He complained to the defendant, who offered to pay half the cost of a new dynamo, and this offer was accepted. The next day, the lorry broke down on a journey to Millsboro, and the plaintiff asked for his money back. Remember, we said that if the person affirms the contract, can't go and seek rescission. Subsequent examination by an expert showed that the lawyer was unroadworthy. It was held, one, the representation as the condition of the lorry was innocent. Two, the journey to Rochester was not affirmation because the plaintiff had to have the opportunity to test the vehicle in a working capacity. Three, the acceptance of the offer to pay half the cost of the dynamo and the subsequent journey to Millsboro did amount to affirmation, and therefore rescission would not be granted. Right? So this is an example of bars to rescission where the innocent party affirmed the breach affirm the contract. So we turn our attention now to lapse of time. Where the misrepresentation is fraudulent, lapse of time does not itself bar rescission because time only begins to run from discovery of the truth. Where the misrepresentation is innocent, lapse of time may bar rescission. We continue to look at the bars to rescission. We're looking at misrepresentation. And the case here is Lifan International Galleries. So here the plaintiff was induced to buy a painting by an innocent misrepresentation that it was a John Constable. So the artist, they said, the painting it was John Constable. 5 years later, he discovered the truth and immediately claimed rescission. He could not therefore have affirmed the contract, but his claim was held to be barred by lapse of time, right? 5 years is a long time. Two further points of interest were made in the Leaf case. Firstly, that the contract was not void for mistake, the mistake merely being as of quality. I will remember that mistake as to quality does not vitiate a contract. Secondly, a claim to rescind for innocent misrepresentation must be barred when the right to repudiate for breach of condition is barred. That is, where there is acceptance within the meaning of a sales of goods act. And we'll look at what that means, but to give you an indication of what it means, simply if the person takes the goods and time has passed, they have not returned the goods, then they are deemed by virtue of their keeping the goods to have accepted the goods as they are. So the next bar to rescission is restitutio in integrum. And if restitutio in integrum is impossible, that is, if restoration to the pre-contract state of affairs is impossible, because, for example, a partnership's capital has been converted into shares in a limited liability company, and you can't get back to the pre-contractual stage. A more obvious example of impossibility of restoration is where the subject matter is food which has been eaten. Certainly wouldn't want somebody to attempt to give you back what they have chewed up, right? A modern tendency is for the courts to award rescission if the substantial identity of the property remains, even though the parties cannot be precisely restored to their pre-contractual position, financial adjustments being made if necessary. So in other words, the courts will use money as a proxy for returning persons to the pre-contractual state. So what about the intervention of third-party rights as a bar to rescission? The third-party intervention. Now, a person cannot rescind an allotment of shares in a company after the company has gone into liquidation, since at this point, third-party rights intervene because the assets of the company have to be collected to be distributed among the company's creditors. So that is another example of the bars to rescission. And bear in mind, I'm looking at rescission as a remedy for breach of contract or the invalidity of a contract, whether it's invalid as a result of mistake or it is invalid as a result of any of the three types of misrepresentation. So when we return, we will look at other vitiating factors, which include duress and undue influence, as well as illegality, but we're going to hold it there for now.